and I see you're all clearly stunned into silence, and there's no hands going up.
All right. No disagreements, no.
No, everyone agrees with every word that Howard has said and has nothing to add. That's brilliant.
I think one brief point, and I think Howard's points are well made. I suspect an awful lot of people have different views on what they may or may not associate themselves with in relation to sort of appeals and so on. But I wonder, forgive me if the Socialist Party's already done this, I don't know, but a really, really well-crafted letter that if you are approached, you could send back to the organisation that approaches you, explaining how you are utterly sympathetic to their cause, but you are not giving for this reason, and explain the socialist point, and then also request that perhaps they should consider diverting their own organisation's efforts to achieving an end that will not only solve their problems but all the other charities as well. I don't know if it's done that, but I mean, I think that would be a useful thing, because then we could all download it as a PDF, sign it, and respond. Now, that said, there are, Howard's obviously pointed out, there are kind of more what one might say personal and urgent issues, that if someone falls over in front of you and bashes their head, you know you want to help them. It's that personal and that urgent. So that must appear in all these appeals in some form as well, I guess. But I think there must be an awful lot of them, that you could respond to with a letter. And so I would thought that would be a good idea.
Yeah. I sort of recall doing that on one occasion in particular, some time ago. I'm a member of the Vegetarian Society, and they publish a magazine which they used to have letters in. They've stopped doing it. Used to have letters in, and they had an article about how if everyone was vegetarian, the problem of world hunger would be solved. And I wrote saying this is extremely laudable, and I obviously wanted the problem of world hunger to be solved, but it wouldn't be solved by everyone in the world not eating meat, because what would happen, in fact, is that other goods would be produced for profit, and only people who had the money to buy them would be able to feed themselves. So the situation wouldn't change a great deal. So I sent that letter, and they didn't publish it. It was a letter to be published. Whether somebody read it and was influenced by it, I don't know. But it's something one can do. It's not a bad idea, in the hope that it will ring some bells somewhere. But I think the people immersed in these campaigns are really immersed in them, and perhaps, you know, we'll brush it off as, you know, with words like utopian, and you know, we've got to focus on the here and now. But no, I mean, it's a positive suggestion, certainly.
It's not sounding like, to me, like someone was volunteering to do the work to produce it.
I'll have a go if you want. If the general feeling is it's not worth doing, I won't. I mean, I often go to I'm very interested in wildlife and the environment, and I often go to the sorts of activities and shows where these people like the RSPB and so on have stands, or the wildlife trusts, and generally you find that people that are engaged with that are lovely people, and they really do want to see an improvement, but they are very single interested. They might be interested in otters, or they might be interested in the reintroduction of beavers, or the sort of lack of high-browed fritillary butterflies or something. And, you know, very often you'll enter into discussion with them, and a lot of them, including a chap I was speaking to the other day with the had a stand at the RSPB, on RSPB stand, he completely understood what I was saying, and he didn't end with, oh, how do you buy stuff? He really did understand it. He said, but, you know, this is what I do, and this is the only way we seem to be able to do it, and all that sort of stuff. But a lot of these magazines seem to be base or the charities very much around sales. So if you look at, for instance, the magazine of the Butterfly Conservation Group, whose president is our friend David Attenborough, 20% of the pages in their magazine are entirely devoted to foreign holidays, so that people go to the Galapagos Islands or Madagascar, look at two or three butterflies for 2 weeks. And, you know, they don't seem to get that bit, you know, the very things they want to say. In fact, their entire advertising content is all these green tours around the world, certain green tours where you fly off to some remote place to see an exotic butterfly. Wonderful that must be, it kind of it's something that you can engage a conversation with them and say, well, look, you guys are doing this, is madness, you know. So I think a conversation with them, I'd write a letter if everyone felt that was worth doing, but probably not if everyone felt it wasn't worth doing.
Mm. Right, I saw a hand right at the back there. Yep.
Yeah, Hal, you very carefully sort of articulated a number of the sort of difficulties in attaching criteria that would lead you to a decision in one context or another. But I still feel that, from my experience, that process is endlessly problematic. So, to take a couple of your examples, Avaaz, like 38 Degrees and 19 other platforms, I don't see any of that stuff now because I've deleted it all, but when I was receiving it, you could say with Avaaz and 38 Degrees and all the others, oh yeah, that's a very clear-cut cause that you would support. But I stopped doing that because by supporting those things that personally I thought were okay, it legitimises an organisation in the context that is embedded with capitalism and supports it. So for Avaaz, for example, I had my support when they campaigned for a humanitarian corridor in Syria, which is how they destroyed Libya. And sort of Blair doctrine of responsibility to protect. And I thought, well, it doesn't matter how many causes I might support, Avaaz is fundamentally embedded counter to my views. And if I took another example of yours, more controversially, even the personal ones, like the support you've given for that asylum seeker. Over the years I've written thousands of letters to MPs and regulatory authorities and that. I've written none now. And for the same reason I would oppose that, your support for the asylum seeker, because you've been required to engage systematically in that oppressive system. The regulatory system, the court system, you've had to lobby MPs. And by doing all that, whether you're successful or not, you've legitimised them. So I wouldn't write to an MP because it legitimised their role. And certainly I've noticed over the years that they've been upset when you stop engaging with them. They're quite happy to send you letters to and fro, and so on. But it just legitimises that, and so it strengthens capitalism.
I'd just like to make a comment that in this society, we're all compelled to be hypocrites. And I think the degree to which you endorse that is a personal decision. That's all right.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with you, Tim, that organisations like Avaaz and 38 Degrees, they're enmeshed in the system. There's no doubt about that, they are. And to a certain extent, if you do the kind of thing I talked about, regarding the young refugee, you are sort of enmeshing yourself in the system as well to a certain extent. Maybe it's true we're all compelled to be hypocrites to a certain extent, but I mean, sometimes our humanity prevents us from doing otherwise. And some people will be more sort of impelled to exercise that in certain cases than in others, and I suppose I'm one of those. But if you look carefully, you can probably pick holes in the coherence of the cases I put to you. Yeah, but I'm sort of trying to sort of think my way through it in a way that doesn't make me feel like too much of a hypocrite, and doesn't make me feel like somebody who is sort of somehow prolonging the system, which I'm as desperate as anyone is to get rid of.
Yes, thank you. My question is it ethical to sign a petition calling for the abolition of the BBC licence fee? My observation is that, and I've no idea, I obviously must have signed a petition at some point online that the two organisations, 38 Degrees, and I think there's one called Change UK, yeah? And once you've signed something, you then get absolutely inundated from these two organisations asking you to sign, you know, more and more things. But they both of them, obviously, to me anyway, they seem to support kind of leftist, reformist options. But the way that they're kind of worded when they come through to you, it's this assumption that maybe because you signed something once, whatever it was, okay, that you are totally and completely 100% in agreement with whatever, you know, it is that they're trying to push.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
So it's ethical yeah. to say, can we abolish the BBC's licence?
Oh yeah. All I can say is that that's a petition I certainly wouldn't have signed. No. Certainly not.
Yes.
And that. Yeah. I mean, I suffered a mental illness in 1988 with schizophrenia. I've been involved in various day centres as members rep and setting up a day centre that's open 3 days a week in Lancaster for people to drop in, you know, have tea and coffee and food and do games and all sorts of things. So I get involved in that, and I'm the treasurer of football. I was the treasurer, just recently resigned over some problems or whatever. But I also get involved with PED, which is a mental health charity that's trying to set up services to improve services for people with bipolar and schizophrenia in doctor surgeries. And they're doing a clinical trial in Plymouth and Birmingham. You know, I've been one of the people that's been going along to set up, you know, the nuts and bolts of how they're going to do it right here. I don't see that as reformist right here. I see that as helping people, maybe stopping somebody kill themselves because they're getting better treatment or whatever, or there's somewhere for them to go. And they might not take their own life. We've lost about 3 or 4 people to suicide, members of peer support in Lancaster. But we'd have lost a lot more if we didn't exist right here. So, you know, mental health's a priority for me right here, as well as socialism right here.
Yeah, can I just say, sort of coming back to what Tim said earlier about supporting the asylum seeker and so on, I mean, what Dougie's just said sort of reminds me of that, because he's talking about, you know, the vital nature of these things, otherwise people might lose their lives and so on. But, I mean, the reality is, Tim said, no, you shouldn't sort of be attending court, you shouldn't be appealing to MPs and so on. Yeah, he may be right about that. But the reality is that if I hadn't attended court in London on a particular day, the odds are that that lad would have been deported fairly quickly back to a country where he knew no one, and his life may have been in danger. Now, in the event, you know, we managed to get him released and so on, he's not living a very, very pleasant life at the moment. He's no access to any kind of income, etc. But nevertheless, he's surviving, and he's got some hope that things might change in the future. So, I can't really sort of see that as reformist activity. It's just sort of helping another individual human being who desperately needs help.
Yes, I've got three of them going up.
Again, just touching on this gentleman who spoke previously, I support an organisation based in Birmingham called Arts All Over the Place, which sets out through art to provide activities for people with mental health issues. I performed in events to they were registered charity, and I, again, echoing what this gentleman has just said, you know, it's performing a vital need, and. Which is not getting the under the system under which we're having to live, receiving the support it should be having. You know. You are sort of constantly asking yourself, well, you know, surely if we were living in a socialist society, people with all sorts of mental health conditions, well, there'd probably be a lot fewer of them, because I've had several nervous breakdowns myself. One thing about capitalism, it drives you mad, or helps to drive you mad, and there would simply be more help for the people who need it. And as the gentleman said here, there is a desperate need that needs to be filled. And, all right, there's also an argument that because funds are raised for them so they can carry on their work, there's donations, you know, they hold raffles, you know, all kinds of, you know, which obviously, you know, involves, you know, money changing hands. But, you know, it's a very, very serious problem. And it's got to be ameliorated some way, because, I mean, I know an awful lot of people, again, going back to this gentleman, with quite serious mental health issues. I'm currently working with somebody who's an actress who's bipolar. For example. There just isn't enough support for them. That's my point. So, until we do get a socialist society, and there is enough, in whatever form, resource you look at to help them sufficiently, how do you plug that gap? You know, repeated myself several times, but that's the problem.
You want to take a few at once, too?
Yeah, I just wanted to say about the hypocrisy thing, because, you know, that's something that I feel quite ashamed of, how I compromise my sort of like principles and values. And, you know, I've just bought a diesel car, God forbid, because it suited my budget. You know, I wear Primark clothes because, you know, they suit my budget and whatever. But, you know, I don't like the fact that I do that. I would much rather be able to buy Tom's stuff and eco, organic type things and whatever. But I think this reform thing is something that I struggle with, because to me that seems like the nitty-gritty of getting things changed, you know. And if we're not doing that, isn't it almost like saying, I want the ocean to be more sustainable to marine life, but actually I'm not prepared to pick up the plastic and do anything about that? You can't have change without kind of expressing it through actions. I don't know, but does that make any sense to my devil's advocate?
I mean, this is the sort of classic argument for reforms, and fair enough, you know, one can't but take it seriously. But the nature of the capitalist system is, no matter how hard you work for reforms, you might be able to achieve a small amount with sort of great difficulty, but there are so many other problems around that are incapable of resolution or can only be partly resolved. And capitalism is only going to sort of give you reforms if it can afford to do so. If it means that profits aren't going to be seriously affected, if it means the system is going to be run more effectively in terms of profit in that particular way. So it's an endless struggle, which it seems as though we must be involved in. Otherwise, you know, we're not sort of real human beings, etc. We're not helping our fellow man. But, I mean, seen sort of more broadly, it sort of perpetuates the system in which we live. And, you know, the same applies, unfortunately, to the, you know, to this gap, the gap you talked about that needs to be plugged in mental health. It does, but it won't be. It simply won't be, no matter how many individuals sort of, you know, put their bit in. It won't be within the capitalist system, because the capitalist system will not put resources into that kind of thing, because it doesn't, you know, it's capitalism is a profit system, and there's no profit in it. Therefore, we can sort of go on and on and on and on doing this kind of thing and get absolutely nowhere. I noticed on the table at the back there, there's a, among party publications, there's one I hadn't seen before, which is a, it's a sort of advert for the Socialist Standard, I suppose, but there's a few sort of questions and answers in it, which I thought were very good. And there's one at the end here, which is a hypothetical question somebody's asked the Socialist Party. This is all a long way off. In the meantime, shouldn't organisations sink their differences, defend working people against attacks on their living standards, and eventually work towards a socialist society? It's the kind of thing one or two people have said here, maybe not quite those words. And the answer given, which I find sort of very cogent, is we all have to live in the here and now, but how far off socialism is depends on when people are prepared to take action to establish it. More than a century of attempts to reform capitalism have shown that none of its major problems can be removed. So if you do nothing about socialism now, the meantime lasts forever. You will be putting off for all time the greatest advance that human society could ever make. So those are the terms in which I would see this argument between, you know, reform or revolution, so to speak. I don't think we can have both. It's either one or the other. And revolution is really, is what the Socialist Party aims for.
Okay, yes, you're next.
I was trying to sort of think through in my head more about sort of the issue, or the angle rather, of boycotting products or companies. I'm vegetarian, so although I don't think that way, that means I sort of boycott or don't buy, you know, sort of animal products. And but again, it doesn't quite feel like boycotting. It doesn't seem that same kind of action. But on the other hand, I do personally sort of boycott McDonald's. I wouldn't sort of buy their sort of vegetarian products either. And that's because I sort of don't like the whole sort of ethos of McDonald's. Although again, I'm hypocritical because I bought stuff from Amazon, and you know that's. That's got similar kind of criticism level to it. Now, with me not choosing not to go to McDonald's, you know, it's not as if that's got Ronald McDonald quaking in his clown boots because I don't spend a couple of quid on a burger. I suppose if more people did that, then yeah, that would perhaps dent the profits of an organisation like McDonald's. But it would also perhaps mean that other people lost their jobs while working for McDonald's, so it had a detrimental effect on them. So again, I suppose that, and again, if you boycott one particular product or industry, then you spend your money on a different one, and you're feeding their profits, and you're sort of solidifying them even more in capitalism, even if another organisation sort of goes by the wayside because people choose not to buy their products en masse. So again, I suppose that got me thinking that boycotting products, yeah, it just sort of shifts money around in a slightly different way. But again, it might have some benefits. You know, personally, you know, from my point of view, it might mean fewer animals get slaughtered. For meat, for example, if there was, you know, mass boycotts of the meat industry, and again, that would probably have environmental benefits as well. But again, you know, you're still spending your money elsewhere and propping up the system elsewhere, even if you're not doing it in quite the same way. So again, I suppose that's sort of similar to the, you know, sort of reformist angle, isn't it, really? Or the argument against reformism, I should say, that, yeah, it sort of tweaks the system here and there in largely insignificant ways. You know, perhaps more significantly if some major corporations were subject to mass boycotts of people. But yeah, it doesn't, you know, sort of get to the fundamentals of the system or the reasons why you're boycotting certain companies or products in the first place.
Okay, now next.
Yeah, I just wanted to lob into the discussion a metaphor or analogy that can sometimes help to look at things in a slightly different way or to reframe things. It's an analogy which I first heard from our late comrade Ron Cook, whom some of you will remember. And he said, imagine a boxer who adopts a stance. Now, a stance is not a rigid position. It's a position from which you can move around, protect yourself in various ways and so on. And if you don't adopt a stance, if you adopt a rigid position instead, you put yourself at a big disadvantage. Now, I mean, I think that analogy might be helpful in the context that we're talking about. I can certainly feel the strength of Tim's arguments about how you legitimise certain organisations if you start to engage with them. I can also feel the force of the points that Howe's making, including what seems to be the important point of suggesting that there are certain things you can do as a socialist within a capitalist society which, as it were, strengthen the socialist personality. Now, I'm not sure that it's really that useful to go beyond adopting a stance, a flexible position here, and spending a lot of time trying to work out an absolutely rigid principled position. Because I certainly, like Howard, sometimes I sign a petition, sometimes I don't. I'm not convinced that I could give any very coherent rationale for the difference. What seems to be absolutely essential, and maybe should get a bit more emphasis, is the distinction between what you might do, you, a socialist, a member of the SPGB, and what the party might do. And it's clear that the party itself can have no trouble whatsoever with the kind of organisations that you, as an individual, might engage with. And that seems to me the most essential one, rather than worrying over much about the nuance of your own particular behaviour. And finally, thanks to Howard for quoting my wise words at the back there.
All right. Okay. I was just acknowledging you. Yes, our friend at the back there.
I'm struggling a little bit, and I hope my question doesn't take us off on a tangent too far. A couple of years ago, I went to a socialist country, and I spent some time there, and it was really good to know that there was virtually no unemployment, and everybody had a home to live in. There was minimal crime. I like that, you know, and it was also a culturally very beautiful place to be, okay? But on the other hand, there were people there that felt stifled by their experience and their creativity was limited, you know? So somebody that swept the streets got paid exactly the same as somebody that, you know, created, you know, designed clothes, and that's why, you know. And so for them, you know, life was quite challenging. My question is, does socialism stifle the individual? That's one question. And the point here about humans are inherently social animals who are made happier and healthier and connected with others. Absolutely, but my feeling is that we should be able to choose freely about who we make connections with. I think that, and also I'm thinking, oh, there are elements of capitalism that could enhance socialism. Thank you.
Can I just say a quick word? Do you mind if I ask you which socialist country you're referring to? Or
sorry?
Do you mind if I ask you which country you're referring to? Or
where I went?
Yeah.
Okay. I went to Hungary.
Hungary? Recently?
No, was when it was still...
Right, okay.
This was before the change.
Yeah. It's part of the Soviet bloc, in other words.
Yes, it was, yeah.
Right, yeah. And you had a favourable impression. Right, okay. Fine. I suppose the difference between your view of socialism and the Socialist Party's view of socialism is that we wouldn't recognise the concept of a socialist country. As far as we're concerned, socialism is a world system. It has to be a world system. And it's a system which doesn't depend on buying and selling. It's a system that doesn't depend on wage labour of any description. So it may well have been in Hungary when you went that, the street sweeper got the same pay as the scientist. I'm a bit surprised at that, I must say, but OK, I'll take your word for it, that was the case. But as you say, people seem stifled. And I think in any country where you've got state control of that kind, tight state control. We would call it state capitalism, by the way, rather than socialism. That people are going to be stifled because, they may have a place to live and a job they can do and sort of get by materially. But the fact of the matter is that they are going to feel stifled because they're not going to be in a position to exploit their talents, their individual gifts and so on. And the whole thing about the kind of socialist society we advocate is that it's a society which will open up to individuals the possibility of engaging in the activities that are congenial to them, which they like doing, but which at the same time contribute to the overall well-being of the whole community. So I suppose that... if you're sort of discussing with people in the Socialist Party about socialism, then it's necessary to know that we're not looking at countries like, the old Soviet bloc, like China, like Cuba, or anywhere like that. That is one way of describing socialism some people have, but it's not the way we would look at it.
OK, I've got five people down the list. Three of them, the three next people, have already spoken previously. Are you prepared to wait to let another couple of people in? Right, OK. In which case, Jacqueline.
Howard said, really, more or less, what I wanted to say.
Right, OK. At the front here.
Thank you.
Yourself.
What about you? I've always thought there's kind of three distinctions, actually, with dichotomism. They're kind of linked up, but they're kind of different. One is the one that you've actually... stressed quite well, really nicely, and that's the distinction between reform, okay, which is doing things actually which tend to prop up capitalism rather than undermining it, and revolution. And to me, anybody who's a socialist is a revolutionist in the sense of wanting to get rid of capitalism and create another kind of society based on socialist principles. Mm-hmm. Then there's another kind of distinction which somebody brought up this morning actually, and it's the distinction of being pro-socialist or anti-capitalist, which is a different kind of distinction, because it assumes that the both sides are socialists, really, and how you deal with it from them. And then it links up to sort of, well, what is the strategy that one takes to transform present society and to create a different kind of society? With the kind of people I'm associated with, which tend to be kind of anarchist and libertarian things, the dichotomy there seems to be between those people who say that within capitalism, one has to create, going back to this kind of human sense, as it were, one needs to create sort of social, voluntary organisations within capitalism which prefigure what the future is going to hold in the form of sort of organisations that are independent of governments and are independent of capitalism. As against those who say, oh, no, that is reformist, what we need to do really is to evolve in the class struggle and to be anti-capitalist. And they're very much strengthening a kind of... It's not just that nobody ever mentions class very often these days, but the sense that being anti-capitalist or being socialist is also to be involved in a kind of class struggle and being, against things. And I think that very often these things sort of interweave with each other. So it's basically the argument amongst most libertarians is the way, what is it, what strategies do we take actually to transform society rather than just being reform versus revolution.
Okay, Howard?
No, it's okay. I'm all right. Yeah.
It's all right. Okay, you're next then.
Okay, we're coming back to a much earlier point now. I'm intrigued that there was a sort of an undercurrent, I think, of almost guilt amongst some of the people here when dealing with what charities they may or may not have chosen to support. But I think what we're underestimating, or perhaps not addressing, and I don't know anything about it, but is the psychology of all this. And I think capitalism as a system is incredibly good at making people feel that, if you like, the ills of the world are there for. So you will have any number of highly skilled actresses or actors paid to give out these Saturday morning appeals for something or other, and this child, if you don't give, this child will probably die, and if you do give, you can pay for X number of vaccines or whatever it is. It's incredibly powerful, and I think we mustn't lose sight of that psychology. And you could also argue, I think, if people say, well, charities are good, and that all that sort of thing, it's a bit like when I had my car broken into and the police came up to me and they said, well, you should have had a car alarm. And suddenly I felt like I was the problem for not having the car alarm, and my car had just been smashed into and everything taken. And I think, that a jokey though it sounds, it's quite important because there's a psychology behind this. So suddenly you're the perpetrator of this problem, not the person that did it, if you like. And I will also finish just by saying, I said to someone this morning, if anyone tells you we live in a civilised society now, you should say to them, well, how can you possibly suggest that a civilised society needs charities in the first place?
Precisely. Precisely.
Okay. I'll see you, don't worry. Right, our friend right at the back.
Yeah, I'll just concur what Glenn said in that regard. The transference of guilt, and coming back to the point of mental health, the idea that mental health is somehow a personal issue predominantly that can be medicalised and financialised is part of the propaganda of capitalism. And so, there's a danger engaging in those mental health initiatives. But you just support the system. But anyway, the general point I wanted to make is that, going back to my earlier contribution, I wasn't trying to appear dogmatic or think there was a solution to this. It's a constant dilemma. Now, I think Keith's point about a boxing stance, where you take a stance, you don't take a rigid position, and you're continually juggling the issues between the personal need to help in various ways, and the political consequences and implications of that engagement. And so, I mean, for me, that would be the most important thing, to admit there's no blueprint, and just continually juggle with that and realise the implications in terms of time, effort, in terms of the risk of being co-opted, and so on and so on. And but I think that does raise an important point in respect to the party's position, because it tends, in my view, to be far too absolute on reformism. Whereas if you take the issues we're trying to explore, going back to Patty's point about if you're not going to be engaged incrementally and systematically, you feel like you're not doing anything useful, I don't think we should be overly dogmatic about our position on reformism, because all the things that Howard's mentioned, including trade unionism, absolutely challengeable as reformist issues and participation. And so I think we should admit that reformism is also a nuanced thing. Again, oscillating between the personal and there's not an absolute definition of what reformism amounts to.
Okay, right, you're next. Oh, you. Yeah, you.
Me?
Yeah, you. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll just let him know that I've seen him.
The aims and aspirations of the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests in France, are obviously reformist. So from that point of view, we shouldn't reform them. We shouldn't support them. But there seems to be a kind of blanket censorship of what's going on there. I mean, they're probably in there something like their 38th or 39th week of these protests now. And so if you want to know what's going on a Saturday weekend in France, you have to look on social media to find out. And some of the stuff is, you know, we know that there's been violence by the state and it's horrific. But, you know, so what they want is reformism, so we should support reformism. But then you've got the issue of the mainstream media censorship. So shouldn't we then do something about helping them get the their message out through other means? Because at the end of the day, and forgive me, I apologise to everyone for swearing, using this word. It's the first time I've heard it used this weekend. I'm going to use the B word, Brexit. But in the same way, you know, that you've got this kind of all the issues around, you know, people trying to stop Brexit from happening and all the rest of it. I just think that it has implications for us as to what we support or how we behave, because, you know, we've got a pamphlet on it. You know, we're getting, you know, we're the party that's going to use democracy to, you know, to change society. And if you're getting this kind of opposition to democracy or to a particular point of view, then even if it means us maybe individually changing our ethical behaviour, should we not do that?
Okay, right, yes, your time has come.
Starting off, Stalin said, one man's life ending is a tragedy. A million is a statistic. The problem is the value of human life. In all, as the previous friends here have mentioned, you know, the idea of, you know, reformism, mental health and charities, these are all aspects of what capitalism, you know, brings to the table. But the idea is they all guilt trip you into essentially following certain paths. But the idea is, essentially, from what I can understand in the simple speech, is to kind of sometimes have to take a step back and look at it a lot more carefully. And as people, you know, looking through, you know, lens of socialism, is to try and make sure that you become a lot more aware. But the problem is, there are a lot of trip-ups. I mean, you've seen yourself, like, in regards to earlier about these charities, you have the same problems that come up that if you don't give money, you feel like, am I a monster? Am I not? And the thing is, it all comes within the context of money. And that is part of it. And going on to my final point about human value, people's big problem at the moment is how we value human life, but we value it through the lens of how much it costs. A lot of people do that. For example, I've given money to people in the street, and sometimes I think, should I give that? I look at the value of the money, I think, what is he going to do with it? Is he going to spend it on drugs? Who about this? And that's the problem capitalism has done to us. And to step outside of that is very hard. To keep that kind of armoured shell around you, you've got to kind of think. And I think that is my point, in addition to kind of concluding, to adding to what's been said here. Thank you.
Yeah, go on. I know somebody else. Yeah, I do agree with the last speaker and with others that there's an enormous amount of guilt tripping that takes place within capitalism. Many years ago, when I was a student, and we had a student SPGB group at the institution where I was a student, we used to produce these screeds, these handouts that we used to put underneath people's doors in halls of residence. And one of them was about charities, and the title of it, I remember clearly, the title of it was "Charity is Necessary in an Uncharitable Society." I didn't devise that, but, you know, I think it sort of... it stands the test of time, really, because as long as you've got the uncharitable society which capitalism inevitably is, you will need charities, because there'll be all sorts of problems to be solved, and some of those problems will be deemed to have to be solved or dealt with, if you like, by charities. Yes, there's a lot of guilt tripping, and you know, I like the analogy of the boxer's stance as well. You know, sometimes we might say, "Yes, I'm going to yield to this." Other times, I'm not. Somebody mentioned Brexit for their sins. Yes, he's not been mentioned this weekend, thank goodness. But I hope I didn't pick up the idea that somehow the party or individuals within the party might somehow take a stand on Brexit. I mean, the party's stand is that it's about the way you run capitalism, Brexit, and it doesn't make any difference whatever to the working class whether... you might think it's a backward move in sort of broad terms of solidarity between peoples and so on. But the thing about Brexit is that the main point is it's one way of running capitalism or another, and it would be fatal for the party to say it's going to support Brexit or it's going to oppose Brexit. No, we certainly shouldn't get involved in that kind of thing. I mean, that's not taking a stance. That's sort of, standing still and allowing yourself to be punched very, very hard. So, no, sorry, we can't possibly contemplate that.
Right, we've had 13 speakers so far from the floor. That's 13 individuals, different ones. Do we have any more first-timers who want to take a turn? Yes.
It's my first time here at the college, and I'm very pleased to be here. I'm finding it very stimulating. But it brings back a memory of when I was in a similar environment at the time of the dot-com crash. Does everyone remember that period?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I worked for a very large telecoms company, and in that crash, the company decided to sack or make redundant 90% of the workforce. This workforce is a professional workforce, very highly qualified engineers. And I wondered what small part I could play. So I decided to stand as a shop steward in the Unite Union. And they sent me to a college similar to this one in Epsom. And they taught me the basics. And our union had to negotiate with this telecoms company. But the CEO was very adamant. He said, I'm closing this building down. That's it. It's final. There's no redundancy. There's no relocation. You're lucky to have, I'm going to offer you a job somewhere else, which was 2 hours commuting away. Now, we didn't take kindly to that in the union. And I made a decision, I suppose you call it, reformism. I thought, well, I'm going to fight for my colleagues. And we did. And we scored a very small victory in the sense that we managed to get some relocation expenses. A lot of people couldn't relocate, so they had to leave. The remainder were forced to move, and they took a small compensation, if you like. But afterwards, I tried to analyse what actually happened, and I concluded that, the dot-com crash was a global phenomenon, obviously, but in this particular case, in the UK, a Labour, I don't know if he was Prime Minister then, but he took the decision to auction the mobile spectrum, right? He thought that was a clever thing to do. And he was probably advised by the Treasury as such. And the effect of that was to effectively bankrupt the telecoms companies. This is a Labour politician. So what could they do? They could not refuse to bid. They had to bid, otherwise they would be definitely out of business. So they bankrupted themselves. They borrowed huge sums of money. Some went to the wall, some survived. I thought, well, an analysis is required here. This is not good enough. You've got comrades here today mentioned the value of human life. You're radically changing people's lives. And I don't think that what I did was actually the correct thing in the end. I think I tried to... I basically helped the management to do their dirty work, really. And the end result was that I think about 40% relocated, and over the years, most of them just couldn't handle the commuting. So, my conclusion is that this tinkering, this reformist activity is a diversion. And one might think one is doing good, but I think I'm closer to the party line on this, that we should be actively trying to bring about the change towards socialism.
Yeah, I mean, capitalism is so full of contradictions, isn't it? I mean, a reform is brought in at one end, and the effect of that is to have that people at the other end of the scale are worse off than they were. So, yes, I mean, it's typical that a government should decide to take certain action, which may, in one sense or another, sort of make things more efficient, but suddenly a whole load of people are out of work. I mean, you know, the classic thing is arms production. You know, you stop arms shipments to Saudi Arabia. Can't do that because suddenly loads of people will have no livelihood. So this kind of thing is sort of absolutely endemic within capitalism. By the way, I think you did your very best in as a trade union representative. I have to say that I don't regard that as reformism, trying to do your best for your fellow workers as a shop steward. At the time, it seemed to you that that was the best solution in the circumstances. This was a classic, as far as I'm concerned, sort of division of surplus value issue. And therefore, as far as I'm concerned, you know, it wasn't reformism. And, okay, in the long term, it didn't work out. But, you know, you never know whether these things will. You know, you do a deal with management on a certain issue. They hold the whip hand. They own the factory. And it may or may not work out. You can't tell in advance, but you've simply got to do the best you can in the circumstances.
Right, I've only got one name on my list, so we seem to be slowing down. So is this going to be our last contribution?
Yes.
I think so. So in that case, it's you. Congratulations, you get the last turn.
Well, I'm just to put a bit more meat on the thing with mental health. In 2010, they closed all the day centres across the country for people with enduring mental health. And we were going to the centres at the time, so we decided to set up our own place, and we got a ribbon of church and things, and then we got a better building, and we got money from the lottery and things. I mean, you can say looking after your job isn't reformist. Looking after people with mental health who have nowhere to go, I don't think that's reformist. I think that's trying to patch up people's lives while capitalism is continuing. And, you know, we're not getting socialism immediately, are we? So, I mean, I think looking after people with mental health, giving them somewhere to go, and actually stopping suicides and things, and actually supporting people financially with benefits and things. It's not the furnace. It's similar to looking after your job and your wages, really, you know, for people on benefits, really, you know, who suffer mental health issues, really. You know. I mean, it doesn't look like it's reformist, but I don't think it's reformist to get involved in that kind of activity, really, you know, in capitalism, because they don't care about people who endure mental health problems because they're not productive, they don't create a profit. That's why they close the day centres. And people fighting back is similar to people fighting back for their job, really, you know.
Yes, he's talking about. Right, I was about to invite Howard to see if he wanted to wind up, but he's just indicated that he's happy to leave it there. So I want to thank you all very much for your contributions. Thank you again to Howard for the talk. Let's have a round of applause. Thank you.